From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Petar Dymchev. He is a candidate for the D.C. Council. He's running for the seat in Ward 3, which is now held by Mary Che, a Democrat. Petar Dymchev is an independent. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Joining us in studio is Ben Jealous. He's the Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland. Ben Jealous, thank you for joining us.
Always good to see you guys.
In Virginia, the attorney general has decided to open a possible child sex abuse investigation of the Catholic Church, trying to see if there has been a cover-up of child sex abuse. Of course, a similar investigation has been started by the D.C. Attorney General, Carl Racine in Washington, D.C.
And Brian Frosch in Maryland. We have, and this is not unique to our area. This is all stemming from the grand jury report in Pennsylvania, 1,000 children victims over decades in Pennsylvania. Carl Racine, the D.C. Attorney General on this show, talked about it and said that he might be looking into it, and of course decided he would after those responses. Mark Herring, the Attorney General of Virginia, has said essentially the same that everyone has said. The Catholic Church is at a terrible time in its history. Children have been the victims. Priests have been victims. And it's time to clear this away once and for all. The good news is the Archdiocese here and in Virginia and around the country and the Pope, and they have all been saying that this time they mean it, that they too are on board to help root out all of this, and that they will cooperate with any investigation. And that there have been no, in the district at least, there have been no allegations for the last 20 years. But, you know, we can't go by what people are now saying. We can only go by what these investigations do.
And Ben Jealous, if you are elected governor and Brian Frosch is re-elected attorney general, is this an investigation you would support?
Oh, of course. Of course. You know, we have to take survivors seriously. That's part of why I stepped out to say that I didn't think that Brett Kavanaugh was fit for the bench. And why it surprised me that Larry Hogan wouldn't. You know, he said he was not educated enough nor qualified to have an opinion on whether Brett Kavanaugh should be on the bench. I think he may have been the only person in the entire country that didn't have an opinion one way or the other.
Prince George's County, Tom Sherwood, has decided to approve matching funds for local candidate. The way it works, a candidate cannot accept a donation exceeding $250. Donations up to $150 that do not come from family members would be matched by public dollars. The bill passed 5-4, but it won't be implemented until 2026, 8 years down the road.
Why? And we don't have to talk about this today. No. I'm not sure where any of us will be in 8 years. But,
exactly.
But you know, that is for the statewide, that's for the county executive race. There are smaller amounts and dollar amounts for the county council races.
Okay.
But the point being, Howard County has income limits. Montgomery County does. The District of Columbia has adopted it. But this is the longest foreshadowing of change and going to 2026 than any of the others. And Montgomery, this is the first season, and it's been very interesting about how candidates have been involved, although some of the candidates who are still standing at this point on the eve of the election are veterans. So, but what funding is a way that the supporters say you'll get a broader reach of people involved and not big moneyed interests if you help the fund citizens who want to run. And now Prince George's is joining that bandwagon.
And it seems that that did expand the participation in Montgomery County's elections this year.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. For the four at-large seats, there were 30-something candidates at one time. So, yeah.
No,
but how does this affect first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mr. Jealous, happy to see you again. How does
Good to see you.
How does the uproar in Montgomery County, which is reliably Democratic county, affect the governor's race there? We're in the, you know, get out the vote thing here. All
yep.
You've made a lot of the arguments for why you should be governor, but now you've got to get out the vote.
Yep.
What are you seeing in Montgomery County? Governor Hogan just, I think, Wednesday was in Gaithersburg, where I must say the Democratic mayor of Gaithersburg,
sure.
Welcomed him and has endorsed him.
Yeah.
How are you doing in Montgomery County? Then we'll talk statewide.
No, we feel good. And this issue of public finance, obviously something that I've supported. I was out there campaigning in Howard County for it, I guess a couple years ago. What we saw in Montgomery County is that it massively increased turnout in the primary. I mean, gee, it seemed like almost everybody knew somebody who was running for county council at large. And it really boosted turnout. What's exciting to us now is that turnout is still high. Folks said, oh, well, you know, it's kind of a one-party county. Once turnout's high, I think part of that is the, you know, the battle between Mark Elrich, who I support, and Nancy Florine. But also there's just something happening across the state. I've been to early voting site after early voting site, county after county. Really hasn't mattered where you were. Turnout is very, very high. We think that bodes well for us. We've said from the beginning, the only way Republicans get elected in Maryland statewide is when Democrats don't turn out. You know, Larry Hogan,
stay home.
Yeah, Larry Hogan, all this mythology about Democratic support 4 years ago, he got 5,000 more votes than Bob Ehrlich did 12 years earlier. And it really speaks to, frankly, Democrats not turning out. Last time a Democrat won for governor, we had more than 1 million Democrats vote for that candidate. 4 years later, a Republican squeaks in with fewer than 900,000 votes. It's simply he got in because we stayed home.
Glad you mentioned that, because I'm going to steal Tom Sherwood's thunder here, because every time we discuss how Larry Hogan is doing in the polls, Tom Sherwood points out that in the primary, the difference between you and Prince George's County Executive Rashaan Baker seemed before the election to be much narrower than it turned out to be in the primary itself. So Hogan is now polling between 50 and 20 points ahead of you, depending on the poll. But as you point out, Maryland is a heavily Democratic state.
Yes.
Are you having trouble galvanizing Democrats at all?
No, we have been, it's been like a snowball. And we're in a place, you know, County Executive Ike Leggett endorsed a couple weeks ago. He was probably the one who took the longest. We had the full support of the congressional delegation, support of the county execs and those aspiring to be county execs. And we've seen the party really come together. This has been a new process for the Democrats in Maryland, because, I mean, think about it, guys, you're the experts. Can you remember somebody, you know, can you recall a Democrat coming through a competitive primary to take on a Republican incumbent for governor? Just, you know, there was O'Malley, but there was no primary. There was Glenn Denning, but there was an open seat. And so I think for our party, it was a real process. But what we found is people have come together. And part of what's brought folks together is that, frankly, we know we got to get our schools back to being first in the country. We have a plan. The governor doesn't. We saw that in the debate. I gave him 5 minutes. He could not describe a plan for education. We have a plan to deal with the healthcare crisis and skyrocketing pharmaceutical costs, and the governor doesn't. And, you know, our party knows that in these times, the people deserve real leadership that's capable of providing real results. And so we've come back together, and we're pushing forward.
Our guest is Ben Jealous, Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland. If you have questions or comments for Mr. Jealous, give us a call at 800-433-8850, because if you don't, Tom Sherwood will take it all up. Here
That's
he is.
True. That's true. I will. Well, this middle of the week, this week, you were up in the Baltimore area, and you were campaigning with an obscure former senator, Barbara McCosby, who's always a campaign a positive for you. That's terrific. But today, Governor Hogan announced yet again that he's got raised another $2 million. Dollars aren't votes, and you believe your enthusiasm will help carry you, but it does seem that Governor Hogan, he's got like $3 million on hand going the last 13
sure.
to 12 days, but you say you've got the momentum. How much of the Trump effect do you think is there? In some states, people are saying that Democrats are going to go out, even if they're not that tied up into state issues, but they want to vote against President Trump. Are you seeing that in your own expectations of turnout?
Oh, yes. No, we're seeing the Trump effect really, you know, I think folks want to stand up to Donald Trump. They want leaders who will stand up to Donald Trump. Larry Hogan occasionally is critical, usually at points when it doesn't really matter too much to Donald Trump, but he goes out there and brags that he's Mike Pence's best friend. So obviously there's some closeness to the administration there. Barbara Mikulski, I got to tell you, that's the most special endorsement I got so far in state. Probably her in state and Obama out of state have meant the most to me. My grandma helped train a young social worker named Barbara Mikulski a long time ago.
Wow.
And, you know, Senator Mikulski was telling me that story, and she kind of teared up. And I said, why'd you tear up? She said, well, your grandma helped mentor me. I said, what did she do? She said, well, among other things, she taught me how not to feel awkward. And my heart almost burst with pride, because you could list 100 adjectives to describe Barbara Mikulski, and awkward would, like, never make the list.
No. So I once tried to interview her at one of the Democratic conventions, and she didn't like where we were standing. She didn't like the backdrop. I don't even think she liked the question I asked her, and it was a pretty easy question. But she took control there. And I thought, well, why not just hand you the mic and you say whatever the hell you want?
That's exactly what happened when I interviewed her here.
But having her out there is the message for the Democrats that, you know, this is an election. The governor wants to be the first Republican governor in, 50 years? To be reelected. You're trying to put it back in the Democratic column. You've been on national television, I think, in news about what's happening in Georgia and Florida.
Sure.
But Maryland, 2-1 Democratic, seems to have been sitting on its hands since 2014 in terms of the state races. The Republicans say they're trying to win some state House Senate races in order to give the governor a veto-proof house in the state assembly. The Democrats have a lot on their plates, not just Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And look, you know, politics always comes down to a battle between organized money and organized people. And if I was like Larry Hogan and was out there willing to take corporate contributions, which I don't, or take corporate PAC contributions, which I don't, perhaps we would have more money too. The pharmaceutical industry has invested a lot into Larry Hogan because they know that I intend to fight them as governor, that I've got a plan to put in place a pricing board and a plan to move us to Medicare for All. And that would require them to actually charge Marylanders prices that are much more competitive to what we're seeing now. And, you know, it's urgent that we win these battles. I was with a man, a white-collar professional in Montgomery County who had just lost his girlfriend, 52 years old, because she's a world-renowned psychologist. She had hit a gap in her employment and apparently was too proud to tell the men in her life, her boyfriend or her father, who's a doctor, that she had begun to ration her own medication because she couldn't afford it. And so, yes, Larry Hogan likes to take lots of money from the big pharmaceutical companies. They've funded a bunch of hateful ads against me for months. He's, you know, down there in the mud with name calling and kind of dubious hateful ads. More out this week attacking women who marched in the Women's March after Donald Trump was elected. That's his campaign. My campaign is a positive campaign focused on a plan to fully fund our schools and a plan to get our healthcare costs under control and a plan to build a more inclusive and robust economy.
That you're referring to an ad that shows a picture of a mass of demonstrators. It looks like the Women's March.
Yep.
But that was a supporter of that was in was that Hogan's campaign or a supporter of Hogan's campaign?
It's the state Republican Party.
State Republican. Well,
who's the head of the state Republican Party?
Well, okay.
The governor.
Right.
You mentioned Medicare for All. The Baltimore Sun endorsed your opponents, but they praised you on the opioid crisis, police reform, urban development, public safety. What they did not support was your Medicare for All plan. They seemed
right,
to think,
or my plan to legalize cannabis for adults.
Correct. They seemed to think that the Medicare for All plan would cost too much. Why not? Why would it not cost too
much? This is fundamentally about stretching our health dollars further. This is about taking on the pharmaceutical companies, getting a better rate. It's about cutting unnecessary management fees. What we see is that every other industrialized nation, people pay less and they get more for healthcare. But here in America, we pay twice as much, we get about half as much. And so fundamentally, it's about taking the dollars we're already spending and using them better. Centrist think tank after centrist think tank, like the RAND Corporation, has said, not only is it smart for the country, it's smart for states as small as Oregon. Well, we're much larger than Oregon. We can do it. We need to do it. These healthcare costs are up 120% under Larry Hogan.
Well, Andrew tweets in, ask Ben Jealous how he plans to pay for his proposals. Is he going to raise taxes on the middle class, and why hasn't Peter Franchot endorsed him?
Well, Peter Franchot has to work with the incumbent governor. We sat down for lunch. He made that clear. He said, look, I just got to stay out of this. I got to work with either one of you. I respect that. That's fine. With regards to healthcare costs and taxes, if you look at them together, what we're talking about is keeping more money in your pocket. As a small business person, somebody who runs my family's checkbook, what's important to me when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to taxes, is frankly, I want a better deal. I want to know that I'm paying less and I'm getting more. You look at Larry Hogan, he keeps talking about record funding of education. Well, why don't we have record results? Let's manage things better. You know, the and in the case of healthcare, costs are up 120% in the Maryland Health Exchange under Larry Hogan, and people aren't getting more. In fact, they're just getting more stressed. And so we know that we can get a better deal, and that's what we intend to do.
Are you saying that you're not going to raise taxes on the middle class?
If you saying is that if you look at healthcare costs and taxes together, the money staying in your pocket will go up and your costs will go down.
You want to, was it you just said you want to raise taxes on the top 1% to help fund part of your program?
That's correct. Okay. So the exception
would
be...
But what is top 1%
income? Yes, so let's be really clear. If we're talking to the 99% of us who don't make $500,000 a year,
okay,
aren't a hedge fund manager, and I mean $500,000 a year as an individual, not even as a household. If you do not make $500,000 a year or more as an individual, if you are not Walmart or another big box store, and if you're not a hedge fund manager who's paying a lower tax rate than the secretaries, then you will keep more money in your pockets under a jealous Turnbull administration. If you're one of the aforementioned three groups, we will make sure that you pay your fair share too.
And we, you mentioned Susie Turnbull. She's your lieutenant governor candidate. She's from Montgomery County.
Susie's incredible. You know, like me, she's raising her kids in the Montgomery County public. I mean, she raised her kids in the Montgomery County public schools. I'm raising mine. Susie's not just part of this wave of women running for office for the first time across the country. She's helped build that wave. Emerge Maryland was co-founded on her porch by Susie, and she's the former chair of the DNC with Howard Dean and the former chair of the Maryland Party. And as you know, Tom, she's given us our pathway to victory. When she was chair of the party, we turned out more than 1 million Democrats to vote for our gubernatorial candidate, and we won.
And that's the goal.
Well, you mentioned big businesses. Cameron in Boonesboro, Maryland, identifies as a small business person. Mm-hmm. Cameron, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for having me. I'm calling to ask Mr. Jealous about his position of raising the minimum wage in Maryland to $15. Now, there's a big difference between Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore and the counties that surround D.C. There's a huge economic difference, and the amount of economic opportunities available and the amount of money surging through those counties is different. So if you had a state minimum wage of $15, it would adversely affect a small business like mine in Washington County in a way that it wouldn't affect Montgomery County. And I like a lot of Mr. Jealous's proposals, but I would have to fire some of the people who work for me and be less likely to hire an untrained, not necessarily well-educated person that
so
goes
what,
through my organization.
What can Mr. Jealous do for you, Cameron, is your question, right?
Well, I think the one-size-fits-all policy adversely affects some of the poor areas, and I run
allow me to have him respond.
Bookstore, so I couldn't.
And small used bookstore. That sounds very interesting.
And for this conversation, we point out the federal minimum wage.
I think
wage
I may know the bookstore.
The federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour. It has not been raised since 2009. But right. This gentleman's concern.
And the state minimum wage is $10.10 per hour.
Right. So his concern is that you want to raise the minimum wage $15 in Western Maryland, Eastern Shore Maryland. Different economies than the suburban Washington.
You know, different shop owners see it differently. I launched my campaign in front of my cousin's flower shop, which is not in Western Maryland, but it is in a poor section of West Baltimore. And she said, yeah, she'll have to pay a few workers a bit more. She also looks forward to selling more flowers. The reality is that we disconnected the minimum wage from inflation generations ago. And in doing that, we have not just resulted in individuals or families taking home less, but entire communities having less, including places throughout the rural parts of our state. What you find, though, is that people working at the base of the economy, when they spend within 2 miles of where they live. So the hope is that the bookstore will sell more books as a result. And we got to take that into this equation. You know, 75% of our GDP is consumer spending. And quite frankly, when you give folks at the base of the economy more, what you see is that consumer spending goes up.
Thank you very much for your call, Cameron.
Well, if I looked at your schedule right today, you started out the day on the MARC train in Silver Spring. Is that right?
Started off on the MARC train at Penn Station in Baltimore.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, we're so centric around Washington. You know. And did you write it down?
Yeah. Wrote it down a few stops too.
And then later today, you're going to be making stops up into like three different stops going north.
Yes.
And the transportation, the governor you know, came out with his $9 billion plan to change 270, 495.
And Jennifer in Silver Spring says, does Mr. Jealous support the proposed highway expansion that Governor Hogan has backed? What would he do to alleviate congestion? That's a part of Tom's
when
question.
I'm in Wheaton, in every forum, Coach and I did a forum on the Montgomery County Executive's race. Every place we go, people say traffic is terrible, and even if you add more lanes to 270 and 495, the surface roads coming off of those expressways can't handle this traffic. What do you say? I know you want to do some rapid bus transit, but if in a nutshell, what's your transportation plan for these people who are stuck in traffic every day?
Yeah. Let me tell you what I won't do. I'm not going to widen highways. The only part of the country that has worse traffic than us is Los Angeles. That was their strategy. There's no reason for us to make those mistakes. What happens when you widen highways, you ultimately get traffic relief for a moment, and then more cars get on the road. You're in the same situation you were in before. There's nowhere to go. And so what do? You use the gas tax for the intended purpose. You use it to make MARC and Metro run more frequently, to expand the footprint, to build out bus rapid transit and plug it into that existing grid. And to, for the state, create a 21st century public transportation plan. There's lots of improvements that we need to make. One example often overlooked, when you look at Metro Access that often serves people with disabilities, what you see is that people have to call for a van 24 hours in advance. And, you know, van drivers are human. Sometimes they forget. Sometimes something comes up. Sometimes the van breaks down and the person can be stuck where they were waiting for 24 hours. I've talked to folks who've had to spend night in a library, spend a night in a bus shelter. That's outrageous. There's no reason why we can't take on-demand technologies and bring it in to things like Metro Access. You can use that same strategy in rural areas to make it possible for young people to get to their jobs by actually having public vans as opposed to buses that are able to move point to point in places on the Eastern Shore and Western Maryland where public transportation, you know, running in a straight line would never be able to have the density of use to justify it.
Some people are suggesting that you could even use variations of the Uber and Lyft concept. In the district, for example, it's had some trouble funding it, but taxi cabs are guaranteed a specific rate to go pick up someone who qualifies to take him or her to a hospital or to a medical appointment. There are a variety of things other than just building more roads.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, and we have to be creative. We have to be cutting edge. But and quite frankly, even when we're looking at buses, you know, we should be focused on moving to electric buses. It's a way to bring down the asthma rate and, you know, unnecessary, untimely deaths of folks because we're filling the air up with, you know, diesel smoke when we could be running on electric buses that would pay for themselves.
Can I go back to the elective politics? Robert McCartney from the Washington Post, who's written a lot about Metro and other issues in the state, pointed out, and as others did, that both the Baltimore Sun and the Post now have endorsed Larry Hogan. And I'm looking at the The Baltimore Sun almost ran out of space on its page, said nice things about you, but said that they were wary of Governor Hogan when he was first elected, but that he has turned out to be far better than they expected, and he deserves another term. These are generally Democratic-leaning, although I guess people would argue that about the Post these days, but the Baltimore Sun tends to lean Democratic, and it seemed to be anguished in saying that Governor Hogan has done well enough to be
talked about in there, look, you know, first of all, I was the only one with any ideas who they actually pointed to, which was sort of remarkable. I'm running against a man
who call you a worthy opponent. Yeah. This is not like a criticism.
Yeah, no. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks firing, you know, they see it as firing the incumbent rather than as a new election. And I get that. But what I'd say is this, you know, Larry Hogan, I'm not running against him. He's an affable guy. I'm running against his record. And what is his record? Well, a lot of things that should have gone up went down, and most things that should have gone down went up. Education, our schools have fallen in the national rankings every year Hogan's been in office. Murders are up 42% statewide outside of Baltimore City, and more than 50% when you include Baltimore City. And I pay attention to those numbers as somebody who had two family members shot, one in Prince George's County, one in Howard County, both in the last 10 years. healthcare costs have surged 120%, opioid deaths are up 160%, and our job growth is so slow that we're dead last in the region in job growth. We're dead last in income growth. If we had the job growth of Virginia, Maryland would have 40,000 more jobs right now, but get this, Virginia's job growth is below national average. And so there's a, you know, as somebody who's a tech investor, who's a civil rights leader, who spent his life, frankly, most of my adult life since 26 as a CEO, I know that we can manage things a whole lot better than Governor Hogan has managed them, and that's why I'm running for office.
In their endorsement of you published this week, the Baltimore-based black advocacy group Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle said that you are, quoting here, not connected to the Democratic Party machine. How much has that perception that you are not beholden to Maryland's Democratic Party either helped or hurt you in this campaign?
People want a leader who's beholden to them. People want a leader who's focused on leading in a way that's of, for, and by the people. I've funded my campaign that way. You know, folks, you know, Stacey Abrams is a dear friend. We've known her since she was 20 years old. We took on a governor of Mississippi, wanted to turn a black college into a prison, and beat him a long time ago. And Andrew Gillum, I've known since he was about 20 years old. He's younger than each of us. And folks have made a lot of the history that we could make, three black Democratic nominees for governor south of the Mason-Dixon. Well, I tell folks I've already made history as becoming the Democratic nominee without taking any money from corporations, from corporate PACs, or from big business of any kind. And that, I think, excites a lot of voters because they say, oh, well, he actually is free enough to follow through on his promises to make, for instance, government contracting more inclusive. I mean, think about it. Women are 53% of Maryland. People of color are 48.5%. We've been told if we ever get 29% of the contracts spread among 75% of the population that we should have a party. And, you know, I mean, it's just outrageous. This is the 21st century. We can do a lot better. And frankly, our state would be producing more jobs if we were more inclusive. My investment company, Caper Capital, where I'm an equity partner, we have invested in about 150 startups in the 5 years that I've been there. I've led in about 24 of those deals. 68%, last time I checked, 68% of the companies we're invested in have a black, Latino, or female founder. The fastest growing company, she's all three. She's Afro-Dominicana. Interesting fact, Tom. When she came out to the Valley, we were the only institutional investor. One of the biggest investors in the Valley wrote a blog saying he would not invest in her. He didn't mention her, but he described her because she had an accent.
Oh.
And the reality is that because of everything she is, she has tremendously successful. Because of that accent, she now sells to entire Latin American companies. You know, because of her African heritage, she's well-received on the continent. She's selling to entire African countries. And frankly, because she's a woman, you know, she seems to have an easier time navigating the heads of school districts across the country that are increasingly women. All the reasons that this guy seemed hung up on not investing her turned out to be advantages. And what we know is that the more meritocratic we make Maryland's economy, the better we all do. Because it's not just people of color and women who are locked out. There's a lot of white guys who are like, I don't belong to that country club. I'm being locked out. I was serving my country while this guy was getting old school ties. I'm being locked out. And so folks see somebody who's not beholden to corporations and corporate PACs. And I think it's a breath of fresh air.
Marcus tweets, and what is Mr. Jealous's plan to help Southern Maryland on economic development and transportation? Southern Maryland is almost wholly reliant on the federal government in D.C. as an employer, causing traffic jams for the D.C. region and making the economy rely on the whim of Congress.
Well, you know, really kind of two things there, I mean, three. One, we've got to use bus rapid transit quickly because it's the fastest thing we can do to unclog arteries coming in. Two, we have to expand MARC out there ultimately. It's the only way that things really get better. Three, we've got to be very serious about getting to universal broadband. You have a lot of places out there. It will be easier to relocate, work closer to professionals who are there if we had better broadband service. Those are probably the three top things.
Here is Mimi in Upper Marlboro. Mimi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Speaking of traffic.
Hi. Governor Hogan has really increased the cost for cruise ships to come into the port of Baltimore. And as a result, a lot of those foreign cruise ships that normally come to Baltimore in the winter, in the fall, are now going to cheaper ports like Charleston, South Carolina. That has a huge impact here on tour guides, bus companies. You know, sometimes some of these cruise ships, you might have 40 local buses that come and pick them up in Baltimore, bring them down to D.C. for a tour. you should make this part of your campaign.
Why, you know, Mimi says, are you not making this a campaign?
It sounds like she might be somebody hurt by this decision. Are you in this business?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mimi. You know, I will look into it right away. It's not surprising, and it really speaks, you know, Governor Hogan's failed leadership on public safety and on transportation has really hurt the Baltimore region and the state. As I said, murders are up 42% statewide outside of Baltimore City, but in the city. It was just folks were just meeting with the kind of a national convention tourism group who said the city's become so unsafe that they're starting to divert, to not recommend the city for convention business. And it has an impact throughout. Public safety in Baltimore, it may seem odd, but it's been a joint responsibility of the state and the city since the Civil War. And the governor, even after the uprisings, never showed up to the joint meetings between the city and the state. We can do a lot better. I worry when I hear that may be part of what's going on here, too, having got the news about convention and tourism. You look at the red line that Hogan killed. I mean, along the purple line, what is it now? About like $12 billion in projected development? Well, so it's not just the $900 million that Baltimore lost. It's all the development that would have happened. I meet with folks from the Anne Arundel Chamber of Commerce. They're frustrated, too, about the red line. So Hogan has been abysmal for Baltimore and really for the state in pretty profound ways. Again, I'm not running against him. I'm just running against his record.
We're about out of time. We're down to the last 10 or 12 days of the campaign. You've got a pretty busy campaign schedule. Yep. You've been outgunned in money. You've been outgunned in the polls, whether they're accurate or not. Give us a glimpse of how you laid it out. The votes for Democrats are largely in the Washington suburbs of Maryland, Baltimore City, parts of Baltimore County, some in Howard. But where are you going to be in the next 10 days where people can see you campaigning to get the Democrats to that 1 million mark?
We'll be all throughout the state. The most important thing is where are our organizers right now? We've opened up 25 offices all across the state. We have 6 times more organizers on the ground than we did 4 years ago. We're up to about 60 as opposed to about 10 4 years ago. And then, you know, we've seen more and more groups, including the Democratic Governors Association, just come into the race with ads supporting my candidacy. From the very beginning, what we've said is that this is about the people. We turn the people out, we will win. And what we're seeing with record voter registration, record absentee ballot requests, and now record early vote 2 days in a row is that there appears to be a blue wave building. And so I would encourage everybody out there, if you got time to volunteer, go to benjellis.com, click volunteer, make sure you're pushing your family out to vote. We vote, we win. Larry Hogan only got in because we didn't show up. And quite frankly, he has no plan to turn our schools around. He has no plan to deal with the healthcare crisis. I've been endorsed by the nurses and the teachers because I'm frankly have a plan to deal with both. And unlike the governor, I have a track record of getting big things done in our state. I was named Marylander of the Year by the Baltimore Sun because in 1 year I led the effort to abolish the death penalty while co-chairing the effort to pass the DREAM Act while helping to pass marriage equality. If we can leap forward on civil rights, we can do that on education, healthcare, and
the
economy.
You've got a big fan in S. Nash who tweets, I voted early for Ben Jealous on my birthday because I'm so excited by his candidacy, his track record of environmental protection, issues around justice, education, healthcare, and his courageous leadership on the right side of history. Is inspiring and courageous.
Can we just point out that early voting started, I think, yesterday in Maryland, and we have repeatedly asked Governor Hogan to come on this program, not even limited to Friday, but any day of the week that he would come. He told me personally back in September that he wanted to make it happen and turned to an aide there and said, make this happen. And so despite the best efforts of Kojo's producers, Mark Gunnery and others and myself, Governor Hogan still has an invitation to come, but we're running out of time.
Well, you know, he's been hiding ever since that debate. Every forum I go to, he's supposed to be at except for one. He has not shown up. WYPR up in Baltimore says he won't talk to them.
Is he sitting on his lead?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. He has a bad record and no plans. So what is he going to talk about?
Okay. Ben Jealous. He's a Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland. Ben Jealous, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
Coming up, Petar Dimchev. He is a candidate for D.C. Council in Ward 3. He is an independent. Before we start talking with him, Tom Sherwood, apparently a lot of absentee ballots went out to district voters, but they didn't indicate to them that there was additional postage required. And so apparently a lot of people sent these things back, and some people say they got sent back to them again. And of course, the U.S. Postal Service spokesperson says they won't deny any voters the right to vote and that people can If they've been returned, just send them in again with the appropriate stamps, or even if they don't. It's just interesting to me that when it happens in the district, we get a spokesperson for the U.S. Postal Service. If this had happened in Boise, Idaho, would there be a spokesperson for
the U.S. Postal Service? Well, I don't know how much attention we've gotten, but, you know, as you can see in the dramatic increase across the country in absentee early voting and absentee balloting, you know, an absentee ballot is important because people want to participate as citizens, and usually the envelope is clearly marked that additional postage required. And this time that got left off for some bureaucratic reason that hadn't been fully explained to me. I don't quite know how many absentee ballots have gone out. I tried to check again this morning. But the Postal Service does say it will deliver these, and the city will pay for it. Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member who oversees the Board of Elections, has suggested that why don't we send out absentee ballots with prepaid envelopes so that that would solve that problem. It wouldn't be a big cost, and it would be one less thing because, you know, one thing that irritates everybody in America is searching around for a stamp.
Exactly, especially these days. Joining us in studio now is Petar Dimchev. He is a candidate for D.C. Council in Ward 3. He is an independent looking to knock off the incumbent, Mary Che. Petar Dimchev, thank you so much for joining us.
Koji, thank you so much for having me. I've been a longtime listener of your show, and I used to work for Mayor Fenty, and a big part of my job was to drive around throughout the community and check up on things, make sure potholes were being filled, trash was being picked up, nuisance properties were being fixed. And it was our ritual at 12 o'clock to always tune into the show. My favorite
segment. This is called pandering.
I was about to say, Fendi apparently didn't listen enough, because had he done so, he would have been reelected when he ran in 2010. Just quickly, Tom Sherwood, the watchdog group Public Citizen has said that Mayor Bowser's rally with at-large candidates, in this case the at-large candidate being Dion Reeder, who is running for office, and the incumbent Anita Bonds. It was supposed to be a get-out-the-vote rally, but apparently Public Citizen says that since Mayor Bowser's campaign put money into this, it exceeded the limit that is permitted by the city's law. Explain this quickly.
Very quickly, it was the Mayor Bowser who has gone all in, the first mayor to publicly just stand up and say, I'm going to try to take a council member out, did a get out the vote rally in Ivy City up New York Avenue. And she put out this big poster on it to everyone, mailed it out, put it online. And it said, get out the vote. And then she prominently listed Anita Bonds, that large council member running for reelection, and Dion Reeder, the endorsed candidate that the mayor wants to defeat Alyssa Silverman. A Public Citizen says that this big party that they had, and hundreds of people attended it, in probability exceeded the $1,000 in-kind contribution that the mayor could give to these two campaigns, and so therefore they complain. Now, Public Citizen is the same group that last year complained about the mayor's own fundraising, and she ended up having to pay a $13,000, I think, fine because she had some bundled contributions that she should not have had. It was a small part of the mayor's campaign, but still they were there.
And the woman she's supporting, Dion Reeder, who said that she launched her campaign arguing that she was against the paid family leave proposal that was introduced by the council member she's seeking to oust, Alyssa Silverman. But Dion Reeder now says she does not have a plan for what to do about paid family leave. She will have one if she is elected, and that it's frankly unfair to ask her about having a plan right now.
It's clearly not unfair, but I was at that meet and greet with reporters at the Bus Boys and Poets on 14th Street yesterday, and she talked about it, and the Washington Post reporter said, well, you know, back you told us in early October you would have a plan on what you would do to fix paid family leave. Ms. Reeder doesn't like, and others don't like, the idea that the businesses will be charged 0.62% tax to help pay for paid family leave. And Ms. Reeder got fairly irritated with the Post reporter and basically then just wrapped up the conversation by saying, well, she was busy getting elected, and that she would address this issue once she were elected, which I would say my covering politics is not a very good answer.
What do you feel about this issue itself, Petar Dimchev, the issue of paid family leave in the district? Do you support the proposal that the council has passed?
I like it in principle, but however, I think that the devil is in the details. And I was supportive of some of the compromises that were put forward. Here's my concern. My concern is that we already have some employers that provide generous paid family leave. For instance, Georgetown University. When I was a student there many years ago, living wage was a big issue. And I was very supportive of Georgetown paying living wage to its employees. And the issue now is Georgetown does have a generous living wage, but under this current proposal, the law as is written, they'll be taxed this additional 0.62% payroll tax. So what I'm supportive of is if we have this in place, allow businesses who offer equivalent benefits to pay lower taxes.
Well, that was a proposal to change that policy and even having individuals contribute, but that didn't pass. The law has passed. Do you support the law as it is now?
I think
if you were elected, would you try to change the financing, which goes into effect next summer?
I'm going to bring all the stakeholders back to the table.
No, I don't want to hear about stakeholders. It sounds like a steakhouse where people are eating. Well, if the one word I could ban in this program is stakeholders. The law is as it is, so if you get elected, you will try to change the law, the fundamentals of how it's funded.
Tom, here's where I come from. Right now in Ward 3, we have struggling small businesses. We can look at it outside just down the street at Cleveland Park. We can look at it at Global Park. Small businesses, and these are family-owned, independent businesses.
So, yes.
They're having a tough time in the city. So what I want to do is come up with a compromise which makes sense for them.
Well, this is what Dionne Reeder said. She would come up with a compromise. There was no compromise. The chairman of the council, Phil Mendelson, spent a year trying to find a compromise, did not find one.
And indicates that he doesn't plan on trying to do that in the future.
As long as he's breathing, he said. But so you will seek, if you're elected, to change the financing of this, because it goes into effect next summer.
Correct. Okay. July 2019, okay. I believe.
All right.
Well, Melissa in Washington will give you a chance to explain who you are, because, Melissa, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Petar, which is how you would meet the evolving needs of Ward 3. We're a big ward. We're a lot of people. I don't know what your plan is then to perhaps manage to meet with us or stay in touch
You'll allow him to give his entire platform in response to that question.
Just give us the highlights, one, two, or three.
Well, I'm really wondering how he will connect with us individually in Ward 3.
The first thing he's going to say is that he was raised in Ward 3.
Okay, well.
He can take it from there.
Who are you? But I think she said, what's your plan?
What do you know about Ward 3?
Yeah. Sure, we'll start there. So I grew up in Ward 3. My family came here from Bulgaria. We came for the same reasons why families have been moving to America for generations. That's the search of better opportunities. And for me, I've been able to achieve my version of the American dream in Ward 3. I'm a D.C. public school graduate. I went to Keyes School, Alice Deal, School Without Walls, stayed here. I went to Georgetown University, obtained a law degree at Catholic University.
Well, have you ever left Ward 3? Oh, you went to Catholic University. Go ahead.
I've left Ward 3, but I've been in D.C. for the majority of my life.
Let's be clear about that. You live in Ward 3 now. Where did you live when you went to Schools Without Walls?
I lived in Ward 3. I lived in Global Park.
And you've lived in Bethesda, though, haven't you?
I did. I did that when I attended Catholic University for law school because, as you know, D.C. is a very expensive city. It's hard to make ends meet. So I made the decision to move back in with my parents who reside in Bethesda.
On River Road.
And okay. While I was in law school, I did live in Bethesda. But since then, I've moved back. So the way I'll stay connected to the community is, one, because I was raised here and because I served as Mayor Svante's liaison, I'm very in tune with the needs of the community. But more than that, I've been knocking on doors since February. We've knocked on over 5,000 doors. I've been to ANC meetings, civic group meetings. We have meet and greets almost every day of the week. And what I hear consistently from residents is that we have full-time problems. Our infrastructure is deteriorating. Look at our roads. Look at the safety of our roads. We have cyclists being hit almost daily, pedestrians being hit, even where I live in Tenleytown. So what we need is a council member who's going to be a full-time council member, all in, all the time for the ward. And in order for me to keep my eyes and ears close to the ground, I'll continue going to community meetings. I'm going to institute a ward-based constituent service office, which will rotate throughout the community every day of the week. So one day it'll be in Palisades, next day in Tenleytown, and so forth, within existing D.C. government buildings, so libraries,
what
park
are you
centers.
Dissatisfied about what Mary Che is doing?
There's a lack of urgency in fixing our streets. We have overcrowded.
She's the chairman of the Transportation Committee. She's put in, I don't want to say how many millions. I mean, she's the chairman of the Transportation Committee. How many Transportation Committee meetings have you attended to complain about her lack of action?
I talk to residents every day because that's who I listen to at the end of the day, the constituents. But here's exactly the problem. I have all the respect in the world for Councilmember Che, but she has been the chair of the Committee on Transportation, and she's been a council member for 12 years. But look at our streets. We just have to step outside to Connecticut Avenue to look at the potholes, look at the safety issues, the fact that we haven't upgraded, we haven't looked at how people are moving around in the city. So for me, it's urgency. It's about holding government accountable, because working for Mayor Fenty, that's what I did.
Well, can we, because people do not know you, let me ask you some questions about your background. You Catholic University. A Georgetown University graduate?
Correct.
In what year?
2008, I majored in government.
Right, and then George Catholic University's law school?
So I worked for Mayor Fenty for after Georgetown until law school for 3 years.
And you were the what they call the moker, which is a horrible initial, but you were basically the eyes and ears, as there are in for even every mayor has in each ward, an eye and ear person.
Community liaison.
Community, Well, that's nice because you can alert the mayor to problems or agencies to problems. That's a fairly low-level job. I mean, it means you go to a heck of a lot of meetings, but it's not a decision-making job, is it?
It's a very important job. At least I can't speak to
other. I'm not saying it's not.
I can't speak to other administrations, but I was very fortunate to be Mayor Fenty's eyes and ears, and for him, it was very important to have a direct link to the community in order to cut out a lot of the bureaucracy that gets in the way of.
Were you the only
needs.
One?
I had a coworker.
There were two of you.
There were two of us. But my job was to make sure that I oversaw anything that the city did.
Right. Your job was to help the mayor stay in touch with Ward 3.
Exactly. But also to advocate for the community in terms of making sure that projects were done on time, on budget. Exactly. And I would frequently meet with high-level government officials. So in a way, I learned how the sausage is made.
Well, Mayor Bowser is Mayor Fenty's protege, and the Washington Post, when it endorsed you, said that they found that your opponent Mary Che's efforts to undermine mayoral control of education worrying, which suggests to me that you are in favor of continuing mayoral control. Do you consider yourself a protege and supporter of Mayor Bowser?
So I'm an independent candidate, and I have absolutely no links with Mayor Bowser. And the Washington Post is an independent body capable of making its own decisions. So I would not say that the Washington Post is really following anybody's lead. They looked at my platform and my opponent's platform and then exercised their own judgment about who has the better vision going forward. But as a D.C. public school graduate, when I was growing up, the school board ran the school system, and we saw how that turned out. I think what has been really important in the last 10 years is the fact that we now have centralized leadership. There's a lot of work to be done in our schools, and I'm very passionate about the subject. However, in any large organization, if you want to effectuate change, if you want to make sure it's well-run, you have to have a centralized system of holding people accountable. Right now, I think it's incumbent upon the council to exercise its role of checks and balances and hold the executive accountable.
And Mayor Che is trying to do that by taking away the Office of State School Superintendent to be independent of the mayor and the school system, so that state superintendent, like in every other state in the nation, will oversee the spending. Do you support that legislation from Mary Che?
I do not. I think it's the council's responsibility to be the ones to actually exercise that oversight, because they have investigatory power. They have subpoena power. So they're in a better position to actually hold the executive accountable as they're supposed to. And more than that,
that's what the state superintendent does, though, is supposed to oversee the school, the chancellor.
And again, it's all about centralized leadership, because it's easier.
Okay. I want to find out more about your background, because I had trouble with it. I saw the video from you at the Palisades Civic Association. You said you worked at the Energy and Commerce Committee. When did you do that?
So this was in the fall of 2013. I was a law clerk.
Were you an intern or an employee?
I was a law clerk. This was while I was in law school. So this was during the government shutdown and the implementation.
Were you employed by that committee, or were you there as an internship as part of your studies?
So it was in legal fellow position. So I was unpaid.
Fellow position, unpaid.
Sure. Unpaid.
Okay. Now you also said there that you worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Mm-hmm. What was that? What job was that?
Same. I was a legal fellow.
You were an intern. That's a lawyer's word for intern. My concern is that I looked at this. You don't in your resume online and elsewhere acknowledge that you lived in Maryland, and I think you're a lawyer, right? And mm-hmm. Are you licensed to practice where?
I'm licensed to practice in Maryland.
In Maryland, not the district. So your appeal to that you're a lifelong person in Ward 3 is you're a lawyer in Maryland, and you had internship at these other places, but not what I would call real jobs.
Well, I'll say this to you, Tom. While I was living in Maryland.
He's applying for a real job in D.C. right now.
How come you're not a D.C. lawyer?
You only have about a minute left. So
sure.
Please.
So I'll say this. So I moved to Maryland to save money while I was in law school. Living in this area is expensive. Even though that was my residence, I spent the bulk of my time in the city.
Yeah,
I went
your
to school
taxes
in D.C.
that you paid went to Annapolis,
but
I would assume.
I made sure that I spent all my money in D.C., but more than that, I was still involved in the community. I worked on local political campaigns as a volunteer, so I was engaged as much as I could within D.C. and D.C. issues, and I still attended regular community action.
In addition to running for council, you are also a DJ, and you perform under the name DJ Dimmy. Why aren't you using the same hashtag you use for your DJ gigs, hashtag Gimme Dimmy, as your campaign slogan?
Because we just met. I wish we had this conversation earlier. What I'll say is my DJing stems from my education as a DCPS student. I went to the Fillmore Arts Center, which is where I learned how to play the violin in the first grade, and that instilled within me an interest for music and the arts that stayed with me. It transformed into DJing, which I started doing because DC is expensive, and in law school I was looking for ways to make ends meet. And for me, it's really important to really bring this focus on the whole child and developing generalized knowledge through additional arts training.
Petar Dimchev is a candidate for D.C. Council in Ward 3. He's an independent. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much for your time.
That's all the time we have. The Politics Hour is produced by Mark Gunnery. To make sure you never miss a conversation with a local political candidate, subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up Monday, we'll hear from Barbara Comstock, the Republican representative fighting to hold on to her seat in Congress in Virginia's 10th District. Plus, we'll do a deep dive into local trick-or-treating. What are the norms in your neighborhood? That all starts Monday at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. Tom Sherwood, what are your plans this weekend?
Is the Marine Corps Marathon this weekend?
Yep, it is this weekend.
I'll be staying out of the way of that.
All right, and once again, Petar Dimchev, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Lauren Marco, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobstorff. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.